I'm going to get called to run out and testify. Okay. I just don't know when.
Welcome, everyone, to the May 10th, 2011 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. Got a number of bills up today, and we have some folks from out of state, so we're going to start out opening a public hearing on House Bill 3149. Representative Cannon, you and your guests would like to come up. That'd be great.
Gentlemen, come up as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, nice to see you again. For the record, State Representative Ben Cannon, House District 46 in Portland. I will be brief. I have my committee to chair at this time as well, and I'm really here just to introduce a couple of guests. The concept that you're going to hear about today, peer-to-peer car sharing, is a really interesting one. I think this is one of the most exciting kind of new business ideas you might hear about this session. It's the kind of the kind of idea where, at least at the conclusion of our House hearing, I wondered, why didn't I think of that? Because it seems that good. And it's good on a number of levels. It's good for consumers who might be able to put an unused car to use and make some money from doing so. It's good for folks who might want to use a car occasionally but not purchase one outright. It's good for the Oregon economy because we have the prospect of drawing a couple of businesses, maybe more, to Oregon from out of state. And it's good for the environment if we can cut down on unnecessary vehicle use through more flexible car sharing options like the ones proposed by and the companies that are run by these gentlemen on my right and left. So I'm going to let John Atchison and Shelby Clark tell you more about the work that they're doing in California, in Massachusetts. The bill would enable these car sharing programs to come to Oregon by modifying some insurance provisions. The bill itself is based on the bill that passed unanimously in California a year ago that has helped make it possible to bring personal car sharing to that state. Hope this committee will take serious consideration of it. We are continuing to work both with the car sharing companies and with the insurance companies on potential additional amendments to House Bill 3149, and it is our intent and our hope to bring to you consensus amendments that will get to where folks want and need to get. So with that, I'm going to let
we can't move the bill
anymore. I'm afraid you cannot move the bill today, and you know, part of that is out of respect to the efforts that the industry is continuing to try to make to get this bill just precisely right, because Oregon would be only the second state in the country to pass this legislation. I think we have a particular obligation to get every detail right. Technical questions, if they come up, we'll have somebody from the insurance division who can speak to how this is consistent with and how these proposed amendments would be consistent with Oregon insurance law. But I hope today the hearing will focus really on the unique business opportunity that the state has here.
Are you close to amendments?
We're very close. Very close. Running, I know you're under...
Running out of time.
I know your schedule because it's ours too, Mr. Chair. So with that, you. I'm gonna turn it over to these gentlemen and I'm going to head to my committee. Thanks for your time.
Representative, yeah. Appreciate you coming down.
Sir. Great. Thank you, Representative Cannon. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is John Atchison. I'm with a company called GetAround based in San Francisco. We offer personal car sharing services. And I'm here to talk about the economic and business benefits of personal car sharing. So I've actually been for over 20 years at the forefront of kind of new technology-enabled services, and I was around in Silicon Valley at the beginning of the commercialization of the web. I was around when the web was transformed into a multimedia medium with audio and video, and I actually personally think that peer-to-peer car sharing is as big or bigger than either of those opportunities. I think this is really an enormous opportunity for the state of Oregon. So let me actually just quickly describe what personal car sharing is and how it works from a business perspective. So personal car sharing is very much like traditional kind of fleet-based car sharing from companies like Zipcar, except that the cars are actually owned by individuals and not by a corporation. So anyone who has some extra time with their car can put their car into a car sharing marketplace and then rent that car out on an hourly, daily, or weekly basis and use that money to offset the cost of their car. The business around this, the companies like Get Around and Shelby's company, Relay Rides, provide, facilitate that marketplace transaction. So essentially, we provide, first off, a technology platform that links the owners of the cars with the people who like to rent the cars. We handle all the financial transactions that go on, and we make it a safe experience, which first and foremost includes insurance, comprehensive insurance for every owner and driver in the system. We do screening of all the drivers to make sure they've got good, clean driving records before they get involved. And we have 24-hour roadside assistance, customer service lines, things that make it very, very safe and seamless for everyone involved. The savings that come out of personal car sharing are really pretty enormous, and they're really all based on one key statistic, which is that 92% of the time the average car in America sits idle, which is an amazing number. So 22 out of 24 hours every day the average car is sitting in a parking lot somewhere. It's really actually the greatest reservoir of wasted capital in the world today. So by using those cars, first off, those who are renting the cars actually, by not owning a car, but using it just to, using it only when they need it, can save several thousand dollars a year. But also the owners of the cars now have the opportunity to generate enough revenue from the rental of that car to actually offset their overall operation and ownership costs, which on the average are about $6,000 a year. So if you're able to rent your car out through a personal car sharing program for just 2 or 3 hours a day, you can completely offset those fixed costs of owning a car. I mean, all your depreciation, all your insurance, all your licensing fees. Tremendous opportunity for both owners and renters. Moreover, all that money stays local. I mean, if I go and buy a car, that money goes directly out of state. If I go into a personal car sharing program, all that money stays right in my neighborhood and gets circulated right in that neighborhood. Moreover, the nature of personal car sharing, because it's so inexpensive to bring additional cars into the marketplace, expands the reach of car sharing far beyond what traditional car sharing has ever done. And I know Dave Brook is going to talk about this a little bit more in just a few minutes. But companies like Zipcar can really economically only offer car sharing in very dense urban cores. So you really, in the state of Oregon, car sharing really only exists in downtown Portland and a couple of university campuses, whereas personal car sharing can stretch to every corner of the state. Any place there are cars, there can be personal car sharing. Finally, just a word about the industry as a whole and the industry opportunity here. It's been forecasted that personal car sharing can be a $6.5 billion industry by 2016. An enormous, enormous opportunity. And I think also, just if you look at the amount of venture capital dollars going into this industry right now, I mean, my company is backed by a group called Redpoint Ventures, Shelby's company is backed by August Ventures and Google Ventures. There's tremendous investment going in this area right now. And I think California really, you know, stepped to the plate last year with their Assembly Bill 1871 to facilitate personal car sharing. I think Oregon is in a fantastic position right now to follow that lead and actually surpass California in being the anchor for this. I mean, car sharing in America was born in Oregon. Personal car sharing should really be launched here. We strongly support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Sir?
Thank you, members of the committee. And if Representative Cannon were here, I would thank him for the introduction. I very much share his enthusiasm for personal car sharing and believe that personal car sharing has the potential to be...
Could you put your name on the record, please?
Yes. My name is Shelby Clark, and I'm the founder of Relay Rides. I share Representative Cannon's enthusiasm for personal car sharing, and believe it fundamentally has the ability to be one of the most profound differences, or to make one of the most profound differences in personal mobility since the Model T. So thank you to John for providing an overview of personal car sharing. I'd like to add some additional thoughts on how car sharing can help to build and fortify communities. As I mentioned, my name is Shelby Clark. I'm the founder of Relay Rides, which was the first personal car sharing service operational in the United States. We've been in operations for about a year, and we've been very pleased with the initial results, the intense curiosity of the press, and the engagement of our members. What I've been most struck by is the strength of our member community. When you speak with car owners, they say that they're feeling like they feel like they're helping neighbors by providing them a convenient, affordable way to get around and making it easier to live car-free in their communities. On the other hand, when you speak with borrowers, you'll find that they feel like they're helping their car owners by providing them income, almost like supporting a local business. They love that their money stays within their community and goes to support a neighbor. What's emerged is an incredibly strong, symbiotic community of neighbors helping neighbors. I initially thought of RelayRide as a car sharing service, but I now see it as a platform to empower communities to improve themselves. We provide the technology, marketplace, and insurance to allow communities to connect. This empowers them to better use their own resources, reduce their transportation costs, or put extra money in their wallets, keep their dollars within local community, reduce congestion and parking problems on their streets, and form connections with their neighbors. The once lost days of borrowing sugar from your neighbor are back, and RelayRide and personal car sharing are helping. We are enthusiastic to bring RelayRide and the benefits of personal car sharing to the residents of Oregon. However, with the current language in the Engross bill, we would not be able to operate in Oregon. To protect our car owners, we only permit safe drivers, as judged by having a relatively clean driving record, to drive RelayRide cars. However, the Engross bill would force us to insure drivers who are not approved members, which our insurer would prohibit. As such, I strongly encourage you to support the passage of House Bill 3149, and I urge you to consider forthcoming amendments to the bill as well.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
I think we're going to have Jessica Roberts be a video. Jessica Roberts on video.
Okay. Hello?
Hello, yes.
Hello, can you see my giant face yet? I'll take that as a yes. All right, are you ready for me to get started?
We are, Jessica.
Thank you so much. My name is Jessica Roberts. I live in North Portland, and I thank you so much for allowing me to testify today through the magic of technology. My family chooses not to own a car. In fact, I've never owned a car. And we find we can meet almost all of our needs through transit, walking, and biking. And while we like being active, I have to say the biggest incentive for us is that we save about $8,000 a year, and that makes an enormous difference in the stability of our family budget. But sometimes you just need a car. I might be in front of you today in person, for example, if I did own a car. We are zip car members. Sometimes it works for different types of trips. Sometimes it isn't ideal, and we find that it doesn't quite help bridge that car gap. We're lucky. We know a lot of our neighbors, and they're very generous, kind people, and they don't use their cars very much, and they often ask us, implore us to borrow their cars, which are sitting unused in their driveways, and we would like to say yes. After all, it's basically in my driveway too. But if we borrowed the car and were involved in a crash, God forbid, it would impact my neighbor's insurance, and that doesn't seem fair to them, and it's a responsibility that leads us to turn down their generous offers more often than not. I've actually tried to talk insurance carriers into writing me a special standalone policy that would bridge this gap, but they don't really know what to do with me. And I only drive once or twice a month, so any standalone policy it just doesn't make financial sense for us. So that's where HB 3149 comes in. All it does is get a loophole out of the way that today is preventing responsible Oregonians from pooling their transportation resources. It would give families more flexibility to meet their transportation needs and help keep family transportation budgets down. It would do that by helping families like mine continue not to own a car, but also by helping my neighbors receive an income from their car that's sitting idle anyway. I really think this is a simple bill that benefits ordinary Oregonians, and best of all, keywords, it comes at no cost to the state. So I would love to see this bill passed. It already passed unanimously out of committee and then passed in the House, and I'd love to see it pass the Senate this session. I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that I have been waiting years for this bill, and it will immediately make a positive impact in my life and the lives of many other Oregonians. So thank you for having me. I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any, and especially for facilitating the magic of video testimony.
Thank you, Jessica. Does anybody have a question to Jessica? I guess there are no questions, so thank you very much. We appreciate that.
Thanks again.
Okay, bye now. All right, Dave, Brooke, and Chris. And John Charles. We didn't get all three of you up at once. whomever would like to go first.
I'll go first. My name is David Brook, Portland, Oregon. I am the founder of the first commercial car sharing company in the United States, in Portland, in 1998, not that long ago. And it worked for FlexCar, which was in operation for a number of years, and now is part of Zipcar. And since about 2003, I have been a consultant for other startups and worked with Relay Rides in the establishment of their personal vehicle car sharing program. But now I'm no longer working for Relay Rides and have other clients. I want to encourage you to pass the HB 3149. I think it's going to significantly expand the scope of car sharing in less dense areas of the state, smaller cities, and the suburban areas in the long run. There's lots of work still to be done, but in the long run, I think it's going to really enable car sharing to serve a lot greater number of people. And the benefits of the personal vehicle car sharing are, in addition to all of those benefits of car sharing, we'll be able to return money, keep money within the community, as some of the other people have talked about. So I think the other important thing to keep in mind about 3149 is that it is patterned after a California law that went into effect in January of this year. And I think it's important to try and keep things as consistent as possible for the good of the insurance industry and of the car sharing industry. And I think it also defines, prevents a bunch of lawsuits that might otherwise happen because of gray areas that people might want to take advantage of. So I think it sends the right signal to the industry that Oregon is interested in promoting these kinds of transportation alternatives and to protect the drivers and the insurance industry as this new service rolls out. So happy to answer questions later.
Thank you. Mr. Charles?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute. And as you may know, Cascade is primarily interested in promoting a dynamic market economy and opportunities for individual wealth creation. And this bill is consistent with that philosophy, and so I'm happy to support it. In some regards, it reminds me of what we've begun to do in urban real estate markets, where in many cities we have large homes built in the 40s and 50s for family sizes that no longer exist. And those homes have excess capacity. So there was, for a while, an underground economy in building what planners call accessory dwelling units, but more colloquially you might know as granny flats or mother-in-law apartments, something to that effect. Well, about 12 years ago, at least in Portland and some other cities, they deregulated the market to actually allow by right to do this everywhere, because before that, granny flats were prohibited. Typically, that's why there was an underground economy. So they deregulated, and instantly, more people began to take an underused asset, create something that worked for the typically a single person renting, and created some cash flow for the homeowner, and so it worked for everybody. But there were some minimum standards established dealing with lighting and where doors were to deal with nuisance effects. So it was a very free market approach, but there were some performance standards, and I testified in favor of that, and I continue to support that. And this is somewhat analogous in that this takes an idea that has especially been being promoted through the use of social media. I believe the San Francisco program, in the House testimony, he said everyone who uses it either is or has to be on Facebook, and social media is driving this quick, instant, seamless sort of way of sharing things and making transactions, and I think that's a good thing. The bill has some insurance clarifications and property rights clarifications that help make this program hopefully work in Oregon, and I support that. And finally, not discussed today yet, is the issue of how prices are established. But in House testimony, when the gentleman was asked, well, how do people determine what the hourly rate is, the answer was, whatever the market will bear. And in some cases, many cases, it would be $8 to $10 an hour, but he did indicate that there was someone who owned a Tesla electric car who found a market for that to rent at $50 an hour. And if there is someone, if there's one person on the face of the earth who wants to rent your car for $50 an hour today, that's what it's worth today. Tomorrow, it might be worth something entirely different. And I'm very excited by this notion that we can create this program in transportation that relies on private, underutilized assets, where consenting adults engage in voluntary transactions for mutual benefit, coordinated, I don't know, perhaps by some kind of invisible hand in the market. And this is a really edgy idea that could have some application, not only in the transportation sector, but elsewhere in the economy. I can envision perhaps maybe deregulating the taxi cartel that has almost impossibly high barriers to entry for people who want to run taxis, or allowing jitneys that have been typically outlawed for years precisely because they're so successful. So I think this idea of the dynamic market economy and prices set on the basis of whatever the market will bear is exciting, and I encourage your support of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam Smith. Chris.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Environmental Council, and we're here today in support of House Bill 3149. Mm-hmm. We actually served on that oversight committee that set up the first for-profit car-sharing company in the United States that Dave Brook mentioned. And it's really gratifying to see how this particular sector a business enterprise is evolving and changing over time and getting better and better. Car sharing is an example of a private venture that provides broad public benefits. It facilitates both the making of money and the saving of money. And car sharing families drive demonstrably less than non-car sharing families, which leads to both economic and environmental benefits. Traffic congestion, less traffic congestion is one. Less reliance on petroleum is another. I just checked the, whatever it's called, gas price check or whatever, and over the last 3 months, gas prices have risen on an average of 75 cents per gallon. And it doesn't matter what the reasons are, what anybody thinks the reasons are, it's true that it's extremely volatile, and those prices are probably bound to go nowhere but up. And then lastly, from an environmental perspective, less air pollution and less global warming pollution. So you've already heard what this bill does, and so I'll simply say that it's really great to see a bill that brings a new enterprise to Oregon that, again, allows some of us to earn money and others to save money while providing environmental protection. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions? Senator Girard.
Yeah, actually, I've been sitting here listening to be for the gentleman on my right, and that would have the insurance end of it. Okay, the person that owns the car has their own separate insurance, and then the person that rents actually has their own separate insurance through the rental contracts of one of these gentlemen here. The question would be, if you go into Portland and you park in a parking lot, you have a bad habit of getting door dings. Okay, so does that mean that every time that somebody's going to rent one or rent these cars, the owner is going to have to circle the car and check the car out when it's returned?
Yeah, it is a rental car, and so at the start of every trip, you do want to just do a quick walk around. But that's what the purpose of insurance is to take care of that, and this bill helps sort of sort out whose responsibility is it is a potential accident at any given time. Your example of door dings is a kind of a gray area because you can't always tell when, under whose watch the door ding happened.
Down here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, well, I guess we're waiting for some amendments, so we won't be able to take any action on the bill today. Excuse me.
I do have some things for the
we
record.
We do have some testimony. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry.
I forgot. A letter from Senator
I've received a letter from Senator Dingfelter in support, and a measure from Bill Scott at SIPCAR, who has no position on the bill in its current form.
So what did his letter say?
That he has no position, and it's in your docket. So
you
can
leave it. For the record, Mr. Chair, he did think he liked the concept.
We'll close the public hearing on HB 3149, and I think we're going to move to HB 2147. Let me say, for I noticed that there's a lot of folks in the audience who I think are here for the seed bill. I'm waiting for Senator Atkinson to come back. And we also have a need, if we're going to move the seed bill today, to have a fiscal statement from the legislative fiscal office that we don't have. We can't move until that, but we'll kind of hope that we can get maybe that before the end of the day. So we're, did I open already? We are open on House Bill, public hearing on House Bill, actually a work session on House Bill 2147.
Richard. Senate Bill 2147 allows applicants for either a wine self-distribution permit or a direct shipper permit to prove their license status by providing the OLCC with sufficient information for verification by electronic means or other means acceptable by the Commission. If you recall, we heard this on May 3rd, and the agency wanted us to add an emergency clause, so we now have that in the form of the Dash 1 amendments, and there's no fiscal and no revenue impact on that Dash 1 amendment.
Senator Edwards, are we on to move the Dash 1s? We are in a work session.
On 2147. Yep.
2147.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2147.
Senator Edwards moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2147. Is there discussion on the amendment?
Can I ask a silly question?
You sure can, Senator.
What's the emergency?
Huh?
I'm not opposed to putting it on there, but...
Preservation of the
Mr.
public peace.
The 21st Health century is 11 years old, and that is the emergency, Senator Girard.
Just because you said that, I'll be happy to vote for it.
Yeah, we'll finish this one off. Is there no objection? Is there any, or I should say, are there any objections?
No.
There are none. The amendment is adopted. Senator?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2147 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Edwards has moved House Bill 2147 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 2147 as amended is passed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. And who would like to carry that?
Senator Burdick wants to.
Huh?
Senator Burdick wants to carry it.
Senator Burdick would be a good
Senator Edwards said he'll carry it. We'll close on that. And which one?
You started it.
All right. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3185. Representative, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. I bring before you a bill that started out, as these things sometimes do, to be much bigger. I have had an ongoing concern with the fact that I drive to Portland on a very regular basis, and there's a lot of drivers on the road, and some of them have cognitive impairments of some kind and another, and they're hard to get at. I mean, we talk about drug and alcohol impairments, but there are other impairments, and in researching this, it was brought to my attention that there is new research, and there's actually very, very good studies being done and tests for cognitive impairment that are directly related to driving, in the past, where it's sort of been a doctor's guess, is this person impaired or not? Now, I want to be very clear on here. We're talking about impairment, and some young people think anybody over 30 is, you know, impaired by the very fact of age, but that is not what I'm talking about. I am talking about other types of impairment. It had been my hope originally to have ODOT actually sort of mandate one of these new instruments that test driving impairment directly. It turned out to have a pretty high fiscal, but the bill before you is a recognition by ODOT and others that this whole issue is important. It needs to be revisited in terms of the fact that some of the baby boomers are moving into a more impaired state, and So I am very pleased that this bill, I hope, will meet with your approval. I have submitted to you, and I apologize, this an amendment. I don't like to bring amendments to the Senate. This bill kind of squeaked out under the deadline, and the amendment basically adds some language that I wanted about. Let me get it out here. Persistent and episodic, which is really good language to describe types of impairment that comes from some of these instruments. And it also adds on this task force, which this is a task force on this whole issue, a representative from the Oregon State Police, because they certainly have an interest here, and it was just an oversight that they weren't on the original task force. So that is the bill. It calls for a task force under ODOT to review our whole system of how we judge people to be cognitively impaired sufficiently that they cannot drive. And I appreciate your attention to my bill.
Thank you, Representative. Questions of the representative?
Mr. Chair.
Not that won't give me in trouble.
Senator.
I'm just curious. I mean, we all know the cell phone. We can tell what a cell phone is, and if somebody's leaving around, we figure they're drunk. What sorts of cognitive impairments are you referring to?
Mostly those related, we know about drug and alcohol, but sometimes there are others that may not show, and often we depend on our healthcare providers to say that someone perhaps might have aged beyond. Age is one that often comes up, but it isn't the only one. Their ability to make the kind of decision making. And as I said, in the past, we've been sort of dependent on the medical community to say, well, my person has health problems and therefore they may not be driving. Out of Canada and also out of New York, there are studies where they actually have tests that test exactly this. Not your cognitive impairment as to whether you can speak or do any other thing, but is your cognitive impairment sufficient that you can or cannot operate a vehicle? That's the kind of thing that I want to get to, so that we're not just saying, well, this person is old, or this person has this disability, or this person has this problem, but can this person actually operate a vehicle, and what is the status of their impairment with regard to that? As I said, I don't think I'm going to get ODOT to just buy these instruments, okay? But they will study the issue and see if they can strengthen sort of the current system, which is basically your doctor decides. And how does the doctor know specifically your impairment in relation to driving specifically? So that's. I think that my will is done here to have ODOT look at this. You might note the demographics. We are getting to be older, and these kinds of things are coming forward, present company accepted. Yeah. And I'm really not trying to pick on older drivers. I'm trying to get at what are the skills that a driver needs as opposed to other activities. And you may be very good at life skills, but have impairments that affect your ability to drive a car. And that's what these studies and these instruments that they've come up with are basically a test that is specific to your ability to drive. And I'd like to have ODOT mandate that we buy that, but I can't. So here we are.
So our committee administrator have questions?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
If you'll permit me. Do you have a sense of when grown children with aging parents who may have some issues with their driving need to step in and maybe take the keys away?
Well, I can tell you this, Mr. Chair, members of the committees. I don't think their keys need to be taken away while they're still paying for the cell phone service of their grown children.
Can I follow up? I think your point is correct, that aging parents are prone to hold things over their children in certain cases when they, you know, want to control their children's lives. But do you think maybe that the older generation is just a little bit jealous that the younger generation knows how to use their cell phones even if they can't afford them?
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, I can tell you this much, and there are those who may be young and know how to use a cell phone, but there's others who know how to read a cell phone bill and know when to kick people off the family plan. No impairment is involved in those kinds of decisions. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing this discussion.
So, I have one.
I think we'll stop that right there. Senator Gerard.
Actually, I have a less humorous one, but we just passed a bill that allows people with visual acuity of 20 over 200 to drive. So I'm trying to figure out where on this cognitive skill level are we going to draw the line, and who's going to determine that line.
And that's what my bill speaks to, is that there are tests that could actually prove that even someone with that kind of cognitive impairment would still have the skill set to drive. That's these new research studies that I'm touting here, if you will, because they test not just what your impairment is, but what your impairment is in regard to the skill set that is needed for driving. That's what we need to get to, some sort of a cutoff that actually speaks to impairment in terms of driving skills, not just, well, they're impaired, so therefore they can't drive, but does their impairment impede their ability to have the skill set you need to drive in today's world? And that's the conversation, that it's right in line with what you're talking about.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you for putting up with us. And our committee administrator gets out of line.
And Mr. Chair, my sympathy with your cheeky administrator. Thank you.
Yeah, I think he's going to hear about that later. Tim McKellen and Rick Bennett are the two that I have here. You want to come up together? That'd be wonderful. Whoever wants to go first.
Go ahead.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Tom McKellen, DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. It was close. I am here to testify on House Bill 3185. The department requires the department to convene a working group, as was just described. There are -A4 amendments that I'll also speak to. They make small changes to the membership of the group and to the scope of the study. Oregon has been doing this type of a program since 1947, long time. But there have been a progression of changes over the last few years to strengthen that program. Prior to 2001, Oregon law required physicians to report every person over 14 years of age who were diagnosed as having a disorder characterized by momentary or prolonged lapses of consciousness or control that were chronic or could become chronic, a fairly limited scope at that time. In 1999, the Oregon legislature directed DMV to study the effects of aging on driving ability and to report the results back to the legislature. An advisory committee was formed, and after 2 years of work, the group concluded that age alone is not a determining factor in unsafe driving, a point that was also made just a moment ago. Rather, the committee concluded that medical conditions and associated impairments are what you should be focusing on. Those are what will affect a person's ability to safely operate a vehicle. The advisory committee also found that the prior mandatory reporting law was too limited. It failed to address many factors that significantly affect driving ability, such as severe cognitive and functional impairments. In 2001, the legislature made modifications to the statute, required that designated physicians and healthcare providers report to DMV anyone older than age 14 with functional or cognitive impairments that are severe and uncontrollable, and are likely to make a person unsafe as they operate a vehicle. We consulted with medical advisors to come up with the standards for those for that program, for the rules to go along with that. Convened a working group, created those rules, and today we believe we have one of the better programs in the country. We have other states approaching us frequently for advice on what we've put together today that focus on impairments rather than conditions, diseases, and things like that. Was a landmark in its time. So. The at-risk driver program also has a voluntary component. According to the bill, we may take a look at the voluntary program if it's necessary in making recommended changes to the mandatory reporting program, but it's not required as part of that study. The bill requires a report in October of 2012, and the group would be disbanded shortly thereafter before the next full legislative session in January of 2013. The at-risk program that we have today has, in the current version of it, it's been around for 7 years, seems to be working quite well. Physicians submit about 1,600 mandatory reports to us. About 75% of those result in immediate suspension of the person's driving privileges, and fewer than 13% of them actually get those driving privileges back, which to us is an indication that we're getting, those that are reported to us, referred to us, are people who do have impairments that should not be driving. In summary, you know, we think we have a good program. We do look forward to a study of this kind. We think there'll be some good things found. We also anticipate there'll be some recommendations that will come out of that we will bring back to you if there are statutory changes required.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP. In previous sessions, I have found myself opposing legislation that Representative Berger has brought forward related to driver's license and shorter renewal lengths of time and so forth for older drivers. In this case, we are supportive of this bill. Representative Berger has been very open to some changes in language that we suggested. AARP has been very supportive and is supportive of Oregon's medical at-risk drivers program. The fact that it focuses on the cognitive and functional impairments that might affect a person's ability to drive safely is certainly the way we think that type of situation should be handled. We're supportive of the makeup of the work group and the areas that the work group will look at as laid out in House Bill 3185. I've also reviewed the Dash 4 amendments, and we would be supportive of that as well. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Durrett?
Yeah, this has to do with ODOT. It seems to me like if you're looking at cognitive skills, I know the most frustrating thing I have with somebody that's in an advanced age is they might be driving 30 in a 60-mile-an-hour zone. But I would, having said that, I would think speed and cognitive skills would have a direct relationship. You know, if you have slower cognitive skills, obviously you shouldn't be driving as fast. So, you know, with the visually impaired, we have speed determinants. Mm-hmm. It seems to me like we'd be going down a path where speed would be a function of the cognitive skill. Is that, I mean, do you see it going that way, or is that something that you'll be looking for in your test?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, I would anticipate it would be one of the things we look at, restrictions on driving speed, hours of the day. But a lot of times people will choose to do that themselves. They don't feel comfortable driving at night. So there's some self-regulation that takes place as well. But I would imagine that the speed would be one of those factors as well.
I have quite a bit of interest in this. A, I'm getting old enough for myself. But B, I come from a rural district, so, I mean, if somebody loses their driver's license, I mean, that really fouls them up. Mm-hmm. And so I want to, this is kind of a slippery slope that I want to be very careful mm-hmm. how we proceed. So I just don't want to be appearing that we're out to take away driver's license, because mm-hmm. I think that should be the last thing. I think maybe the restrictions coming in prior to that would be something I would look at before, maybe. Yes, sir.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a guess for the department. A question about, I'm looking at the makeup of the task force, and how it says an expert in how cognitive and functional impairments affect driving ability. So we have, I mean, we have experts or people that you could...
Chair Byer, Senator Edwards, I believe we will find people. The question will be how you narrow down some of these categories to pick the person to represent that particular area. But I think we will find people that will be very valuable on this committee, and each of those categories have been identified. There's also a lot of research across the country, around the world as well, that we can draw from for this study itself to pull in some of that medical research that's been done. A lot of best practices, but also evidence-based approaches that have been fully studied, researched.
Okay.
The Dash 4 so. Amendment adds the state police to the committee membership there, too.
Yeah. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3185? Sir, please come up.
Actually testify, but there were some questions raised, so then I might be able to answer some. My name is William Mary. I am the president of West Coast Program Research Development, and I help companies build their programs related to public health and help with public health directives. And I'm also the director of development for a company called DriveAble Cognitive Assessments. And when this was originally brought to life, House Bill 3185, we supported it. We still do support it. We think it's a very important bill. And one of the questions that were raised were about experts in the field. And let me give you a little background on DriveAble. So it went through about a decade worth of research because doctors were asking for a tool to be used in the setting that would be able to identify cognitively impaired drivers with a high accuracy rate. So DriveAble was developed and is now moving through the United States pretty quickly. Hospitals in Oregon are implementing the program as we speak. And so I work with leading researchers, doctors, and experts in the field of cognitive driving issues. So there are experts out there, and a lot of research has been done in the last decade to really put out great tools that can be used to accurately predict driver competence. So as far as, you know, older drivers as we age, there's a lot of conditions that we look at for cognitive impairments, and it could, you know, with older drivers, that's not what it's about. We're looking at medical conditions. ISS patients from 15 to 98, and those have to do with traumatic brain injuries, early onset of Alzheimer's, individuals who have had strokes or heart attacks and are recovering, trying to get their license back. And I work with a lot of neurologists in the state that refer to me to do that for them. And one of the instruments would be our tool, the DriveAble Cognitive Assessment Tool, and it has a 95% accuracy rate on predicting an individual's ability to safely drive. And so that's unheard of. It's leading in the world for the technology, and leading experts in the world actually are the ones who developed the tool that I use now. And so we do have a scale that we determine people's ability to safely drive. Either they're a pass, a fail, or indeterminate. The indeterminate go on to an on-road assessment, in which the researchers have implemented in cities around Oregon. So these individuals are on the road with trained evaluators to make sure they are safe to drive if they fall within that area. And I think something we have to think about is the education of doctors, the public, and, of course, family members. But, you know, we have to be careful when talking about limited licensing, because still those individuals, they're cognitively impaired, and that's an issue. And they need to determine where they're cognitive. Just because you have even early onset Alzheimer's doesn't mean you're still not okay to drive. It's those later stages that it becomes of concern. And so if you're allowing someone who is cognitively impaired, even in a rural area, to be driving, it doesn't mean they still don't have the ability to kill someone. So we need to be very careful where those cognitively impairments lie and if they are still okay to drive. So personally, I don't want cognitively impaired peoples in my neighborhood driving, especially with my daughter out playing. You know, it is a risk. And, you know, I do have facts. I do have some material I'll submit to you that you can look over that has some facts and some ideas. But, you know, a good thing that there was a study, and it showed that cognitively impaired drivers are 7 times more likely to cause a crash, which is 50% higher than an alcohol-impaired driver with a blood alcohol level of 0.08. So this is an issue that needs to be addressed, I think, still. And we support House Bill 3185. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Senator Edwards, do you have a question?
Not necessarily for this individual, but for somebody that's perhaps Representative Berger, I don't know, or somebody from the department.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ask your question. We'll see who can answer it.
So my question is, all the testimony, well, not all the testimony, but the testimony is largely focused and the discussion is largely focused on people who are aging. But my question is around people with developmental disabilities, and to what extent does this apply or not, and were representatives of the developmental disability community consulted in the drafting of this bill?
No, not by me directly, and I don't believe that this, let's just say that I am not aware of a problem in that area. But my goal would be that if there is a problem, by coming to a common set of driving skill sets that we're looking for, that we can measure, that we will get to the same place no matter what the disability. Does that make sense? I came at this, as Rick mentioned, because some of us are losing some skills but not others.
I don't point that out to Senator Girard very much.
I know, I wasn't talking to Senator Girard. And that's what started me, but as Mr. Bennett indicated, it isn't about your age. It's about your ability to drive. And so the same would apply to anyone in any disabled population or no matter what the cognitive situation of the individual. So I think it's good for all, but I don't believe there was a direct conversation, at least, and I didn't hear all the testimony in the healthcare committee because it was quite extensive on the House side. So that may have come up, but I didn't.
So follow-up commentary. Mm-hmm. So I guess my follow-up commentary would be, I mean, I agree, and I believe that that's where you're headed and where you want to head with this. For me, what's more important than the word cognitive impairment is function. And the reason I bring this up is because, you know, as we wrestle with language to describe those that are developmentally disabled, in fact, we've had that discussion at least on the Senate floor already this session about removing the words mentally retarded from our education statutes. I know when I started to work on developmental disability issues, I went to a town hall or a meeting, you know, locally, and I was a little bit embarrassed because I said, I'm not sure what's the PC word now. You know? I mean, I didn't know, and the person there from the Lane County ARC said, well, cognitively impaired is the word, and so, and yeah, and I didn't expect that you would. And so when we have a bill that's focusing on cognitive impairment and the link between cognitive impairment and driving ability, I want to make sure that we're focusing on driving ability, not just a blanket, hey, if you're cognitively impaired by some test,
and you can't drive. Mr. Chair, if you'll allow me, in the bill it says persons with cognitive or functional impairments that prevent the person from driving safely. And I think that some functional impairments are pretty obvious, physical impairments that would prevent you from, but I think we're trying to get at those things that are not so obvious. I mean, we know DUII is a type of impairment. If you're drunk or high on drugs, you're impaired, and we have some standards for those. What we don't have is other types of these things. So I appreciate the heads up that I'm stepping into a language issue that I didn't even know was there. But I think cognitive and functional are both sort of the language of this bill.
And follow up.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate you bringing the bill. Regardless of reason, I don't want people without the ability to drive safely on our roads either. And so, I mean, I will support the bill. I feel comfortable that we've had that conversation now. It's on the record, and the department understands my concerns, and we can move forward.
Really?
Thank you.
Really?
Skip it.
Senator Girard.
Oh, I can do without. I'm good.
Good?
Yeah.
Okie dokie. Thank you very much.
I saw the look.
We'll close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 3185. Senator Atkinson, would you like to move the amendment?
I would like to move the -A4 amendment to House Bill 3185.
Senator Atkinson moves the -4 amendments to House Bill 3185. Is there discussion on the motion? I see none. Is there any opposition to the motion? The -4 amendments are adopted. Senator.
Mr. Chair, I would move the bill as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson moved House Bill 3185 as amended by the -4 amendments to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion?
It's not a task force.
It's a work group.
That's too close for my comfort. I will support the bill moving, and I do not want to serve on the work group. Thank you.
Is there any objection to the bill? Seeing none, it is adopted. House Bill 3185, as amended by the -4, is moved to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. And Senator Girard wanted to carry this bill.
Oh, God!
We had lots of questions.
None other.
Okay, we will close on that, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2159. Richard.
2159.
Isn't that right?
Minutes?
Seats?
Oh, yeah.
This is
Senator Atkinson's
moment.
It's not my moment.
Down there.
No.
House Bill 2159 expands coverage of laws applicable to seed production. We heard this bill back on February, March 29th. We now have a -12 amendment.
Oh, we do.
That does quite a few things, including setting a standard default seed contract if the contract is not made before planting, as well as some parameters that can be varied from that seed contract if a contract is validated before seed planting. I have no revenue impact, but I have not yet received the fiscal impact.
So hope by the end of the meeting. Senator Atkinson, would you like to comment on this? Thank you for setting up and overseeing the work group.
Thank you. This is a very long bill. It's a very good bill, and it has wide consensus support, which means we need to pass it in a hurry while everybody's there. Just kidding. What we do need to do in explanation of the bill is not here for me. I'll save my comments for the floor, but we do have several representatives who were from the work group who need to put some things on the record regarding the amendment, and that's critical. If we could move back to public, or actually in work session, let me first move the -12 amendments, make a motion to move the -12 amendments into 21.
Okay.
59.
Senator Atkinson has moved the dash 12 amendments to House Bill 2159. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the dash 12 amendments to House Bill 2159 are adopted.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
You sure can. Senator Gerard.
There was a bonding piece to the 789. What's included in this now?
Let me, if we could, if I could have Senator Beyer come up. And we're going to have former Speaker Mark Simmons come up. He's not here. We're going to have Brian come up, but he's not here. So flying all by...
I'm hitting solo.
No. Fellas, come on up.
Oh,
everybody who's a member of my work group needs to come on up. Fellas, come on up.
Seats?
Oh, yeah. Come on. Come on. The Speaker and the Senator won't bite.
I have to sit in the middle because that's what moderate this group.
There's Brian.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here representing the Oregon Seed Council in support of House Bill 2159 with the dash 12 amendments as you have just moved. Thank you for that. Senator Gerard asked a question as to the bonding piece and how that will be handled in this new bill. Senator, the bill... Senate Bill 789, which was the bonding bill, did not make it past the deadline, as you are well aware. What we have done in Section 9 of the Dash 12 amendments is we allow the department by rule to institute a process that will require seed dealers to provide the department with financial assurance for performance if a seed dealer or any if a seed dealer... If it's required. What we've done in that is the department may, and we won't put this on the record, that the department may do this on an individual basis. If a seed dealer, individual seed dealer, has not been able to cover contracts they have let in the industry. And we also want to give the department the ability to do this globally, make the same requirement for all seed dealers if the seed industry as a whole has not demonstrated financial assurance to growers. So what that financial assurance is, we're going to leave that department determine that by rule. It could be as simple as seed dealers submitting financial statements when they renew their license. It could go as far as requiring bonding. We want that to be determined by rule, not at this time. Also, at the Senator Atkinson's suggestion, we put it also into the draft 12 amendments. There's a section, let me find that section, Section 13 will require the department to, if they write rules on Section 9 of the bill, to come back to the legislature and report as to why they have done it and how they've done it. So that's how the bonding piece is taken care of.
Sure, sure.
Thank you. By introduction of the bill, there was four bills that we were working on, Senator Gerard, and they're all now collapsed into the massive dash 12. Senator Beyer spoke, I think. We'll just allow everybody to say what they need to put on the record. So, Speaker Simmons.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson, members of the committee, Chair Beyer. My name is Mark Simmons. I am the executive director for the Oregon Grass Seed Bargaining Association that originated the bills. I think we've had a good process. We're in the Dash 12 amendment. We had actually four versions of this bill before we ever got to the legislature, taking input throughout the seed industry. And I think we've come to a good product. It does allow the contract guidelines that are otherwise not available to growers to be a reality here in Oregon today. It allows the discussion about a bond and dealer financial assurance to continue at the Department of Agriculture, and we think this is a major and positive step for the seed industry, and we are in support of the Dash 12 amendments.
Could you please explain, just for the record, the addition of a contract that was not there before that we have done with the Dash 12?
Well, what we have done, Senator Atkinson, is in many cases, SEED was contracted on nothing more than a handshake, and now we have a default contract in statute that will prescribe if there is no written contract, or if a contract wasn't provided to a grower until after the seed was planted, there's a default contract in statute whereby that prescribes payment date, allows for establishment of an objectively reasonable market-driven price. It takes care of storage of the seed. And this is a new thing in the Oregon seed industry, and we're very much in support.
Mr. Chair and Senator Atkinson, I'd also like to put on the record there's also a provision put into this amendment that although all new default contracts would have a minimum term of 2 years, this would prevent, and we are then allowing seed dealers to renew and growers to renew contracts without taking out the crop and planting a new crop. And we've done this 2-year term to make sure that if someone goes into a default contract, they can't say, well, it's only good for 1 year, and then we're going to renegotiate all terms of the contract. So that allows for a 2-year minimum term on the contract.
Could you also comment on the UCC and why that language was put in?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson. One of the problems in the industry has been many contracts are written without a pricing mechanism or a price stated, or the pricing mechanism will be the dealer and the grower will mutually agree upon a price, and they never are able to mutually agree upon a price. And the Department of Agriculture has been instructed by the Department of Justice that those are unenforceable contracts for the purpose of the slow pay, no pay. So these new contracts will use a section of the Universal Commercial Code to help establish what will be the pricing mechanism in those cases where price is not determined in the contract. That is ORS 723050. All contracts do not settle the price will use that mechanism to help settle the price. And as you heard in the first committee hearing on this bill from Mr. John Albers, the reason that Universal Commercial Code has not been available to these contracts in the past, because that is Universal Commercial Code is a body of law written for the production or the sale of goods, and these are production contracts. These are not the sale of goods. So therefore, we have to specifically write that into the statute to make it that part of the law, which is a long-established, well-adjudicated section of law, and make that applicable to these types of contracts. Mr. Chair, I would also like for the record to put on specifically Section 2, Sub 2, and Section 3, Sub, make sure I get the right one, Section 3, Sub 4. The intent of those two sections is that if a seed grower has fulfilled all parts of a comp seed production contract, with the exception of delivering seed, because the seed dealer has not yet asked for the seed to be delivered. In this bill, all those contracts will require a payment due to the grower either March 15th or May 1st. And what this section is intended to do, it is very difficult to read, and it takes, we've been through at least 4 dashes of amendments on this one section of the bill trying to make sure that it does what we want it to do. So I want to say very clear for the record is that if a seed grower has done everything required by him under the contract, with the exception of delivering the seed dealer is liable to making those payments on those dates, even if the seed grower has the seed. That is the intent of those two sections of the bill.
Brian, please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you,
Chair. Put your record on the record.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. I'm Brian Doherty, and I'm here testifying on behalf of the Oregon Seed Trade Association. Senator Atkinson asked a question about the contracts, and I would like to put just a few things into the record, as both Roger and Mark have done. We have two contracts here, a Section 2 default contract and a Section 3 contract that allows the parties to set more terms. Both of them have the similar pricing mechanism. Both of them have an ability to, by contract, set the price or set the price that is to be determined. If you cannot do that or it's not mutually agreed, you would default to this UCC provision. Section 2 contracts apply to contracts that were not executed before the seed was planted, to planting agreements that were not put in writing, or contracts that do not contain the sufficient terms to qualify as a Section 3 contract. Section 2 provides for price and payment terms, as well as establishing responsibility for storage fee and risk of loss. The parties could, by contract under Section 2, establish a method of setting the price, or the price will be determined under this UCC provision under Section 72. There's also this two-year minimum term for a Section 2 contract. What we want to be clear is that those do not apply to renewals of Section 2s or Section 3 contracts and do not apply to Section 3 contracts. The two-year minimum is simply applying to a Section 2 contract. The record that there's a delivery of seed pursuant to this bill is a defined term under Section 1-6 and must be made pursuant to notice from the dealer. So a delivery, as being specific, has to be from a notice of the dealer. Section 3 creates an exception to the default language in Section 2 by allowing the party to set a different price, payment, storage, or risk of loss terms as spelled out in Section 3 if the essential terms required by Section 3 are authenticated prior to the seed being planted. That's the key term. The intent is that the parties may enter a memorandum of understanding or a full contract prior to planting, so long as the central terms of price and payment pursuant to Section 2 or 3 are included and acknowledged in writing by the parties. The parties intend that the language of Section 2 and 3 are intended to allow a Section 3 contract that uses either the Section 2 or Section 3 payment terms. And this is the final item I'm going to state. Section 3, subsection 3, allows for extensions or renewals of contracts originally operated under either Section 2 or Section 3 and allows the parties to utilize the original terms or adopt new terms so long as the payment terms are compliant with Section 2 or Section 3 payment terms. Section 3, 3 contracts are not subject to the two-year minimum. That's all I had to say that was in printed that would cover all the things lawyers told me to say. And I do want to say that this, I want to thank Mr. Berger and Senator Atkinson for all the work that they put into this. The Dash 12s were not easy to get to, and there was a lot of cooperation from my counterparts here at the table as well, and I really do appreciate all the work they did, and I appreciate the work Chuck Taylor did to keep this moving for us as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but the OSTA supports the Dash 12 amendments.
Thank you, Brian.
We do need to say a special bit of thanks to Mr. Taylor, who, if you're watching, I hope you plant lots of grass seed and don't have to mow it, because we pretty much wore him out through all this.
12 amendments, we've noticed that.
The great industry compromise here falls into three main points and two minor points, not to diminish them, but 5 points, let's say. First of all, is a uniform contract or contract provision that's real. That was one of the things that Speaker Simmons' organization was most interested in, and the industry did come together on that. Secondly, for a cleanup of the entire industry, really was a true payment schedule, and when do we get to slow pay, no pay? The payment schedule in the seed business is unlike any that I've ever experienced, with no exception. But we did get that in there. And then the third major component was a vehicle of financial assurance. The minor points are, number one, that financial assurance would be determined by the Department of Agriculture by rule, which would inevitably allow everyone in this group to comment on and force the legislature to come back before we got into hard set bonding rules or hard set financial assurance rules that would be one side fits all, which wouldn't necessarily work. And fifthly is the storage provision, which, believe it or not, was an issue that we worked through at great length. I do think, though, that just by way of public record, two gentlemen are just sitting right neatly tucked behind this panel of three, and I believe they should come up, put their name and organization on the record, and anything else that we have missed.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You very much.
Thank
chair,
you for all your work.
On also, thank Senator Atkinson and Mr. Berger for getting through this. And this is for the committee members who haven't been in this. This is a major rewrite of many years of seed contracting law. That it was. It sounds simple from the outside when we're looking at on the outside looking in. But Senator Atkinson and Mr. Berger were very had to keep work very hard to keep us on task to get this done. So we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for all the effort.
actually I made.
Senator Beyer and Vice Chair Atkinson, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Brent Bolton. I'm with the Scotts Company, and I must say that this has been quite a trying experience. I have to thank Senator Atkinson and Mr. Berger for their undying dedication, and also my colleague to the right here, Mr. Dunn, and the OSTA. So.
Well, thank you. I think I want to share the sentiments expressed by everybody here about the effort put in by Senator Atkinson and Richard Berger, as well as the wording that went through Mr. Taylor. And there's another person present, Risa DeMasi, who is an OSTA representative, who behind the scenes, not in the work group, but behind the scenes, would review each and every letter of each and every version of the dash 4 through 12. I think the entire experience has been a learning experience for the organization and a learning experience for me personally, and I do am once again convinced of the commitment level of our representatives here in Salem, as represented by you, Senator. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Can I get you to put your name on record?
Oh, it's Bill Dunn. I'm the president of Oregon Seed Trade Association and the executive vice president of Seed Research of Oregon in Corvallis.
More?
Is there anybody else that needs to put something on the record? Because after this, it's me putting things on the record, which should scare you all.
Always dangerous.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. We'll move the bill.
Thank you, gentlemen. I, too, want to thank all of you who have been involved in this laborious process, and Senator Atkinson, who I asked to chair the work group, and he pushed it through. This is the second one this session that he's done for me, and I appreciate that a lot, as well as Mr. Berger, who's always does fine work for us. So we're going to recess on this one, and hopefully we'll get a fiscal report before we adjourn so we can pass this to the floor. But for now, we're going to recess the work session on HB 2159, and we're going to move and open a public hearing on House Bill 2329.
Richard. House Bill 2329 amends the statutory definitions of all-terrain vehicles to add a Class 4 vehicle type and expands the membership to 13 members on all-terrain vehicle advisory committee. I also have a letter from the president of the Pediatric Society in support. And I have minimal revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact on the measure.
Thank you, Richard. And I have two people signed up, Kylene Stone and Ed. I'm going to let you say your last name.
Arinello.
Arinello. All right.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Kylene Stone. I'm an assistant director at the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Thank you very much for scheduling today's hearing and our possible work session on House Bill 2329. This bill really represents the current thinking and the culmination of approximately a year and a half of work on the part of a group of people who have a stake in all-terrain vehicle recreation, including concerned parents, safety advocates, people who ride, law enforcement officials, dealers, manufacturers, land managers, safety advocates, and other state agencies. And so I'm pleased to present it to you today for your consideration. I apologize, I had a lapse there. There is a an amendment. Did you? Is that? So there is an amendment that I'll talk to you also. It's a very simple amendment, and I'll talk to that at the end of the testimony. Just really quickly, a short history of the ATV program. As some folks may wonder why the State Parks Department is here presenting this bill. We don't actually operate any ATV riding areas in Oregon. However, the responsibility for the program and the financing for the grant part of the program was transferred to our department in 2000 from ODOT, and so we've been administering it ever since 2000. And back in 2007, there was quite a bit of activity and quite a bit of press over several ATV-related deaths, particularly of children, and Senate Bill 101 was passed in that year, which established the ATV safety program, and we, as a result of Senate Bill 101, implemented a fairly significant online safety training program, and currently have had about 110,000 people, children and their families, pass that online safety training course. And we're currently working with 4-H and some other many ATV riding clubs and enthusiasts to develop a hands-on component to that training as well. In 2009, then, last session, ATV enthusiasts came back to the legislature and brought up some other issues that had been cropping up, particularly as it related to this new type of vehicle, what we're calling Class 4 in House Bill 2329. And as a result, Senate Bill 578 was passed in 2009 that established the ATV Advisory Committee that has basically recommended what you see before you today. And we presented their findings to both the interim House and Senate Transportation Committees, and 2329 was born. Just really quickly, what the bill does, it creates a new class of off-highway vehicle in Oregon, and that would be Class 4. Right now, we have three classes of vehicles. We have Class 1, which are essentially quads. We have Class 2, which are Jeeps and dune buggies, street-legal vehicles that people ride off the road. Then we have Class 3, which are dirt bikes. What's sort of missing in all that is this relatively new form of ATV, which is sometimes called a utility vehicle or a side-by-side. Those are the gators that you see sort of on the grounds here at the Capitol, the Polaris Rangers, variety of machines like that, that are similar in size and sort of function to a quad, but are currently, most of them fall in the Class 2 category and are essentially relegated to the same trails and roads that Jeeps and street legal vehicles would be on. So this cleans up the vehicle classification and establishes a special separate category of ATV just for the Class 4s. They're different. They're distinguished from Class 1s primarily in two ways. A Class 1, a quad, is a vehicle that's operated with handlebars, and one of these side-by-sides is operated with steering wheel. And then the other distinction is a Class 1 is you're meant to straddle the seat, and in these you're meant to sit in the seat. It's either a bucket or bench seat in the Class 4s. The implication of that and the reason that's important is that has different safety training components to it for one type of vehicle versus another. So having a separate class will allow us to provide the right kind of safety training, particularly for young drivers. This bill also does a couple of other things. It adds three positions to the ATV Advisory Committee if through the amendment. The original 2329A adds a seat for the Class 4 representative. It also adds a seat for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and then the amendment actually adds a seat for a person who represents people with disabilities. And then finally, this House Bill 2329 corrects errors in the code that have been out there for a while that would allow appropriate prosecution of violations to the ATV code. There was an error in the earlier code that essentially used the word and when they should have used the word or, so that certain conditions, three conditions would have to be met before a judge could cite a parent for endangering their children, when the intent really was that one of three conditions be met. So this cleans that up as well. And again, why the bill is needed: safety training requirements are different for the different types of machine, and this allows us to provide the right kind of safety training. It also helps land managers plan and design appropriate riding experiences for the widest variety of vehicles, and as I mentioned, it corrects errors to existing statutes. The bill does not impose any new fees. It doesn't apply anywhere except for on public lands that are specifically open for ATV recreation, and it does not mandate, prescribe, or prohibit any use of any type of vehicle in any location. Really, all decisions about what is ridden fall to the on any specific piece of land fall to the land managers, who take into a lot of factors before they decide who can ride and who can't ride on their property. And with that, I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have some concern with the bill, two concerns actually. I don't know if they're enough to get me to be a no on it, but I'm a little skeptical of why you need the bill, first of all. And my second degree of skepticism comes from I represent the Johns Peak area that has been nothing but filling my inbox for the last decade about the hassles between the off-road user's fee and the parks not letting the fee go back into where the money was supposed to. So if you know what the story is, that they decided the ATV community to tax themselves in order to work with the Parks Department to make sure that the fees got on the trails and trails were maintained. And in Southern Oregon, I don't know how many emails I got this week, but I get emails of people concerned that those fees don't come here. Year after year, I have gone and talked to the Parks Commission about it. And year after the year, the issue hasn't gone away. So you're telling me that we got to have this bill for side-by-sides, which to me is a work vehicle. I don't own one. The Lord does want me to have one, and if he needs the model number, I'll be happy to email it to him. Tell me that this isn't just more regulation that I'm going to have to answer emails on.
Chair Byers, Senator Atkinson, I will try. This bill was really the recommendation of a wide variety of stakeholders who come together and have actually requested that we do this, including users, riders of ATVs. And these utility vehicles are actually quite popular in recreation areas. And if we don't have the bill, essentially what happens, well, there's two things that happen. One is that we continue to relegate riding this kind of vehicle to roads, essentially where Jeeps ride, and Jeeps tend to ride up the roads, and these vehicles are really meant to be more on trails and not on particularly rutted up roads. And so with this legislation, it makes it easier to put these kinds of vehicles on the same riding areas as, say, the quads, which are a much more similar kind of vehicle. If we don't do this, then essentially what happens is that most of those utility vehicles stay in that Class 2 category, which is where all the Jeeps and the dune buggies are, essentially, and they're very limited riding opportunities for those kinds of vehicles.
Absolutely. So is there money going to follow?
Chair Byer, Senator Atkinson.
To come up to the commission and urge the commission to let the money follow where the users say they want it to go, and it turns into a political conundrum. And may I have to keep doing that?
Chair Byer, Senator Atkinson, I can't make you any promises, but what I can tell you is the way that the committee works, representatives, and again, the statute adds a Class 4 representative onto the allocation committee that issues the recommendations for grants, and so there will be a representative of this type of recreation on the advisory committee. And the commission, essentially, just in response to that, the commission 99.99% of the time approves the recommendations that the ATV Advisory Committee has made, and we don't ever withhold ATV funds. We have a process where we allocate those funds and we issue them out in grants. Now, there was an issue at the end of last session where the legislature took some of the ending balance and moved it to the invasive
program. Can't blame them for that.
So that was out of our control. But the money that we have,
we're going to get through this hearing without talking about that.
We do spend it on the ATV program, and I will tell you, in fact, we have recently issued a fairly large grant an acquisition in the Johns Peak area to the Motorcycle Riders Association, and it was a controversial decision.
It
but
was.
Our commission ultimately did issue
Thank
the
you.
Grant.
Well, just two quick comments, and the little fund sweep deal was a very interesting maneuver. Don't know too much about that, but by way of adding somebody to that thing, that's fine. I just need to put that out there for Johns Peak. If the Lord does, in fact, Terry, and give me a side-by-side, preferably, Lord, the Polaris 850 with the dumping bed, I don't want to be on the work group. I don't want to be on that panel. Thank you.
Chair Vice Senator Atkinson, we will not send you.
Either in orange or desert camo.
Great. Are we done?
I don't know, Lord. Are we done?
Please.
Okay.
Senator Byers. Well, in case he wants to catch it on cable access. Go ahead.
All right. My name is Ed Arnell. I'm president of the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association, have been since 2004. I've been in several committee meetings dating all the way back to 101. And I have to say that I and the OHV community have the same concerns about how funds are dispersed or managed in some instances. And they do have to be watched over carefully, such as what occurred in the last session. And we all have to be aware of that because they are dedicated to the community. And it does clog up your emails and your telephones. And our people are very active. But I represent all the OHV clubs, association. Well, we are the association clubs, members, businesses, and most of the 160,000 OHV permit holders in the state, and take that quite seriously. And so I'm here today, and I want to let you know that as leaders of the OHV community, we diligently have been working with OPRD and with the ATV Allocation Committee to really make sure that they hear us and they hear the users as you want them to be heard. We're active enthusiasts, our kids, whatever age, to senior citizens are very active. And we really want to make sure that every piece of what is presented by the ATV committee is heard. We know that originally a lot of discussions were around the safety, a lot of the discussions were around rider fit. We were at these meetings and we heard them very diligently discuss all the needs, especially the trail use, where these vehicles are starting to cause some challenges. So we believe that this Class 4 specification is much needed, and it will clarify and make it for a safer environment. And we look forward to the future needs that we have, such as in additional safety for these vehicles, for motorcycles, rider fit programs, such as we already heard earlier today about how cognitive facilities and functionality play more into things than age. And we think that some of that has been taken into consideration here and will in the future. So with great respect for OPRD and the work they did in the ATV committee, we support this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2329? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing, and I think I'm going to open a work session and get the amendment done. Maybe that'll get us in. Chair moves the A6 amendment to House Bill 2329. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any opposition to the amendment, to the motion? Seeing none, the A6 amendments to House Bill 2329 are adopted, and we will close the work session on that. We're waiting the fiscal report. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2192. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2192 allows Universal Service Fund monies to be expended by the Public Utility Commission to map or survey the state to determine where broadband services are available. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Mr. Wolf, Ms. Young, and Mr. Conway, come on down. This should be easy.
Could be.
Mr. Welcome. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association. House Bill 2192 fixes a mistake from the last regular session of the legislature.
Mistake.
In short, the Oregon Universal Service Fund, the Public Utility Commission came to us, the industry, and asked if we would object if part of the Oregon Universal Service Fund could be carved away and used for a matching requirement that they had for a broadband mapping project. So the industry basically conferred. We decided that wouldn't be a bad thing, and we would not object to this. Language was developed that would accomplish this. One thing led to another. It was the end of the session. The language that we all agreed to is not what was actually adopted and is in the statute currently. House Bill 2192 removes the offending language and inserts the language that we all agreed to originally. That's all there is to this bill. There was no opposition in that House committee. I have had to relearn that nothing is really easy or non-controversial here in the building, and there were 12 no votes on the House floor. Basically, I believe the opposition was just a lack of understanding about the bill. Folks weren't in the committee to hear what we were trying to do, and the perception was that the industry, quote-unquote, was trying to do something kind of screwy. So, that's not the case. I will close with that, I suppose. And we would ask that the committee pass House Bill 2192 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
I'm just surprised you just didn't take that whole subsection 6 out. Michelle, would you?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barb Young. I'm the legislative director for CenturyLink in Oregon. And given the fact it is now 4:45, with regard to Mr. Wolf's testimony, ditto.
Ditto. I like that.
Right.
Conway.
She's doing. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Brian Conway. I'm the administrator of the telecommunications divisions of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. And I'm here to report that the commission does support this amendment. And hope you will pass it out.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the benefit of the committee, this is something that y'all passed last time when I was still on the commission. They actually did, as was promised the legislature, the PUC did generate the map and didn't spend any of this money.
No. Good to know, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Seeing none, we will open the work session on House Bill 2192, and the chair would move House Bill 2192 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. House Bill 2192 is passed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. The chair will carry. And we will close the work session and the public hearing on 2192. And that leaves us with opening a public hearing on House Bill 3377.
Jesus, Richard.
Done yet?
House Bill 3377 allows photo radar in the city of Salem.
Oh, did you do anything?
There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Radar.
Isn't the...
What's it related?
Hey, is the amendment done?
Yes, but I'm not going to have a fiscal or revenue. I got it. Your staff brought it down to Carolyn right before.
So we got the amendment, though?
Yes.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Lieutenant Steve Burr. I'm with the Salem City of Salem Police Department, where I hold the rank of lieutenant. I've been employed with the City of Salem for almost 30 years. And we come to you asking for your support on House Bill 3377. Currently, there are 10 cities in the state of Oregon that are authorized to run photo radar programs. City of Salem, the third largest state in the state of Oregon, is not one of those cities, and this is a very narrow focused bill. It would simply add the City of Salem to that list of 10 existing cities so that we could implement this as a tool to help keep our citizens safe. Throughout my career, we've addressed things like robbery, burglary, rape, the things that we think that are major, yet every time we go to our neighborhood associations, the number one thing they want to talk about is people speeding in their neighborhoods. We believe that photo radar is an effective tool to help address that issue. As you're aware, every biennium, each of the four cities that currently has implemented a photo radar program must submit an impact statement to the legislature. The 2011 executive radar summary stated that photo radar program has been in operation in Oregon for 16 years. It appears to have a positive impact on reducing average speeds within the communities in which it is used, with high public acceptance and safety benefits of reduced speeds in school zones, residential and other roadways. It appears to make a positive impact on the safety of the communities in which it is used. Furthermore, on April the 1st, U.S. Department of Transportation announced, and something we should all be very proud of, it, death rates on our highways have been the lowest since 1949. NHTSA stated, in fact, we're even greater in the Pacific Northwest, where we saw a reduction of 12%. The The Department of Transportation has taken a comprehensive approach to reducing roadway fatalities by promoting strong traffic safety laws, coupled with high visibility enforcement and through rigorous vehicle safety programs and public awareness campaign. We believe that photo radar would simply assist us in doing that by creating a very public education program, and I would be available to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Lieutenant. Are you aware of the Dash 1 amendments?
I am not.
Senator Atkinson, would you like to fill in with the Dash 1 amendments, too? Senator Atkinson has some amendments to your bill.
Oh, they're
that's a relating clause.
Oh, they're very, very friendly amendments. they allow photo red light to go on here and City of Salem, and I've talked with Representative Comp about this. It's the amount of money that is raised from the sale from photo red light before it would go into the general fund of the city. We would like to use those funds to repair some much needed repair work here on the Oregon State Capitol grounds, namely the very bad sidewalks that are owned by the city. And the street, which it didn't fit into the bill, which you practically need four-wheel drive to get into the basement here at the Capitol. So we would say yes to the photo red light, but before the city gets the loot, we'd like them to be a good neighbor and help us with our sidewalks.
Does it hurt?
I'd like to introduce Mark Bechtel, who is from our Public Works.
Here we go.
Wait a minute.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and Senator Atkinson. We did get wind of these amendments, so.
Oh, there's no secrecy. In fact, they're hot off the press. So.
Chair Beyer, Senator Atkinson, City of Salem has a partnership agreement or arrangement in our city code on sidewalks. Basically, the property owners are responsible for the sidewalks adjacent to their properties. And the city is responsible for repairing sidewalks when the city street trees cause the damage to the sidewalks. There's some other provisions in Chapter 78 of our sidewalk code that deal with that. But basically, in reference to the Capitol grounds, if those sidewalks are being heaved up by the street trees that are owned by the city, so basically the perimeter street trees, we're just a phone call away. All we have to do is have the Capitol ground staff give us a phone call, or Parks and Recreation, or DAS, whatever the governing agency is, and we can come out and grind off those offsets to replace the sidewalks.
I think he would like your amendment.
I think he'd love my amendment, too.
Yeah. On the other hand, Senator, our code does place the responsibility for sidewalk replacement other than damage by street trees on adjacent property owners, in which case it would be the state of Oregon. So this amendment would create somewhat of a disconnect between our adopted city code and your amendment.
Sure. May I comment?
Oh, you certainly can.
I think that this amendment would simply create love and harmony between your city code and this particular establishment, because here's the issue. The issue is that all of the state trees, all of the trees which are, according to you, between the sidewalk and the street owned by you, have popped all the concrete up. And in days gone by, it used to be that was good enough. You fix it. You grind it. But several of us worked very closely to make sure that that wasn't taken away from DAS, who used to manage the Capitol grounds, and moved it into State Parks, which has done, hands down, the best job. The Capitol Mall looks the best it's ever looked under State Parks. Also, we have recognized, the good chair and I and President Courtney and as well as Representative Comp, when I take them for a walk around the sidewalks, which are yours legally, technically, they have been patched for so many years that they look horrible. And all you really do is you walk from patch to patch to patch to patch. And it certainly does not live up to the standard that we have set before us here with the state park. Also, interestingly enough, I have heard from advocates of many people with physical disabilities that say, man, I need extra time to get in here based on how bad the sidewalks are. So it was up to us to enable to do that. Now, as far as the roads, I do know that our very able crew here at the Capitol in the direction of Mr. Burgess has been in talking with the city to fix the horrible State Street and the horrible Court Street and the two side streets that run adjacent. Those streets have got gigantic problems when it comes to sidewalk safety that, frankly, I don't really want to wait for a task force to meet for the next 3 years before we do anything about them. Mm-hmm. The entry and exit right outside here into the Capitol parking structure, honest to God, I took a senator at the other end of the far right of the dais. Senator Girard and I went to lunch today, and we went out because we, just like everyone who comes to Salem, are the economic driver during session. We're the biggest draw in town. This is it. And I took Senator Girard and hit our entrance at a relatively higher rate of speed, actually a normal rate of speed. I had full cognitive skills during this demonstration. As we nearly got airborne from the lack of repair from the city of Salem on State Street. So this little bill just clarifies that we don't want to wait for a task force, and we don't really want to wait for somebody else to have a committee. We just want to get the money into the fund to fix it so it's beautiful. Because this is, I mean, City of Salem, this is your biggest draw. You're the capital city. This should be your shining example of perfection.
The senator just had a little bit too much energy drink this afternoon.
Chairman Beyer, Senator Atkinson, if I could address a couple of things. First of all, the City of Salem already provides a lot of services to the state of Oregon that were not reimbursed for by property tax revenue, including such things as providing assisted security to the state police when you have escapes from Oregon State Hospital. Furthermore, this bill really isn't a revenue gainer for the City of Salem. City of Medford reported in 2010 they issued 2,000 citations in their photo radar program with less than 1,500 convictions. To administer the program, you also have to pay a third-party provider to help do that. Frankly, if the revenue is going to be extracted from the program, we're probably going to tube the ability to provide safety to our constituents before this even gets off the ground.
Well, in response, I think that's a fine point. I think there's 2,000 people in Medford that aren't really happy with photo red light, which makes this gives this bill particular political problems because photo red light's not all that popular. And I believe that if the Dash 1 amendment were in the bill, it would actually have greater political support. And if the City of Salem wanted to get this off the books and so they could have the money free and clear, they'd fix the sidewalks quicker. To me, this is about making this place beautiful. That's where the fee's coming in, or the Dash 1 amendment is.
Sure.
I mean, I see your point. Don't get me wrong. I respect your point. But I've been working on this building for over a decade, and it takes forever to get anything done. I'm not saying that directly to you. I mean, that's, for crying out loud, before we ever looked at the City of Salem, we had to fix ourselves.
Chair Beyer. Sure. Senator Atkinson, I think I have some good news for you. The citizens of Salem in 2008 passed a general obligation bond for street improvements, $99.8 million in bond authority. Two of the streets that are funded to be reconstructed are State Street and Court Street, from 12th Street here all the way to the Front Street bypass. They are tentatively scheduled to be done this coming summer, summer 2012. That would be completely new pavement, probably close to 4,000 feet of curb just on Court Street alone. We actually have a tree that serves as curb, the roots, in some parts of the street. So the citizens of Salem are putting forward, out of their own property taxes, money that will directly benefit the Capitol grounds here. So you will get new driveway approaches put in as part of that, which may solve some of the issues that you just talked about. And you will get new pavement, which I agree is sorely needed, especially Waverly Street. We're trying to get that done as well as part of the project. So that's three of the four boundary streets to the Capitol building. The only reason why that project might delay past next summer is we have a workload issue and it may be delayed, and we're trying to stay away from your long session summers. We don't want to compete with your sessions on your long sessions. So it would be either this coming summer or shortly thereafter. But as far as sidewalks go, if we're going to put almost $2 million in Citizen of Salem tax money into the streets, we'd sure like to partner with the state on the sidewalks. Maybe state parks and DAS and capital administration could come up with funds for the sidewalks if we're rebuilding the streets. Just an idea.
Sounds like we got a deal.
Chairman Beyer, Senator Atkinson, if I could respond to one thing that you did say. You said that 2,000 people in the city of Medford probably weren't happy about photo radar. To be honest with you, I don't know anybody that gets a ticket that's happy about it. Unfortunately, you pass laws, and somebody has to enforce those, that being the police department. And I wish I could make everybody happy about that, but that's sort of the nature of the beast.
Good point.
And so, we can move the bill, or we can move the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'm a no on the bill, just because I don't like photo radar. And I believe, I'll have to go back and check my record, I believe I voted against photo radar in other instances, and had intended to do so, and then this carrot was dangled in front of me with the dash ones, and so I don't know, I'm considering that.
Okay.
The bill, standalone okay. Bill.
One contingent, yes.
Yeah. Unamended, I'm a no.
An unamended, no.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, reverse what Senator Edwards said, and that's where I am. And I want you to know that it will be a great personal sacrifice because I have voted for all the photo radar bills, and each time I get a photo radar ticket. Shortly thereafter. No other time do I ever get tickets.
Well, sure, Senator Gerard.
I'm a no.
Without explanation. Anybody else want to jump into this?
Either way.
Yeah, I don't support the bill.
Huh?
I don't support the bill.
Well, offhand, it looks like we don't have the support to get this out of here. So I am going to, unless there's anybody else who wants to testify, I'm going to adjourn the work session, the public hearing, and I think that's it for the day. Well, I have to carry over because apparently we can't get it out.
Thank you very much, committee.
Mm-hmm. We're going to carry over House Bill 2159, awaiting the till Thursday, I guess it would be, awaiting the fiscal. So with that, we're adjourned.